When I was 16 years old, I got a phone call from a kid in my hometown who said he wanted to get together and jam. It seemed like we had a lot in common, but somehow we had never met. He was from the other side of town. We were both drummers who had grown up playing with our piano-playing fathers. The blues and R&B were in our DNA, and we were both reared on the word from Mose Allison. As a matter of fact, this kid was even named after Mose Allison. His name was Moses Petru. He came over to my parents' house with a conga drum under one arm and a big grin on his face. We were the same age, but he was much taller than me, and he seemed more independent somehow. But when we played, it was just a total groove. I don't remember what we played, but I do remember what it felt like. And that was how a more than 30-year-long friendship began, with a phone call, a conga drum, and a groove. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Moses Petru is one of the most naturally musical people I've ever known. He doesn't just play the music, he is the music. It's in the way he walks, it's in the way he talks, it's in the way he thinks, and I can tell you it's even in the way he drinks. This is a person who doesn't just sing the blues, he lives them. I sensed that from the very first time we met. In the early 2000s, when we were in our 20s, before either of us really knew what we were doing, we started recording some of his original songs in my parents' house in Madison. At first, we were just messing around, trying stuff out. Moses moved to New York before I did, and by the time I arrived in 2005, he was already embedded on the scene. He had a real musical community in the city. He was one of the few people I knew my age who had that already. He became my guide. He introduced me to the cats. He took me around. And at the same time, I brought him into my world, commercial music, advertising, session work. We became each other's guides. I've always floated a little more above the line, and Moses has always been a little deeper in the trenches, living the music life with everything he's got. So when I moved to New York, he and I picked up the pieces of that record we had started years earlier in my parents' house. First, we were recording in my apartment in Brooklyn. Check out this track that we did. It was recorded in the kitchen of my first apartment in Park Slope. I remember that at some point we talked about calling his album Music from the Land of the Good Groove, because Moses was so deeply into Brazilian music, Cuban music, New Orleans music, musical cultures built on clave and rooted in the African diaspora. Ultimately, we ended up calling his album Introducing Moses Petru, and we released it in 2007. But it wasn't just the release that mattered. It was the process. We made it because we had to, because the music was there already and we were just finding it. Moses has been quietly persisting in New York for years, working as a percussionist, a drummer, and more recently as an organ player and as a singer. He's gone from sideman to frontman, from accompanist to artist, and back again. He's played on most of the records I've made over the last 20 years. He's the secret sauce on the albums I make with my dad, my solo albums, even the things I produce for other people. For example, he's all over the most recent single I released with Leonor Watling. That just came out last week. It's not too late to love someone. Let your heart accelerate. It's not too late to have some fun. I tell you, it's never too late. And when we play together, me on drums and him on percussion, we lock into a thing we call the Funkasaurus. We've done it with my dad for years, all over the world. There's a live recording of us in Japan from about 15 years ago that we even call the Funkasaurus.
Oh, what's that I hear? Sounds like a Funkasaurus. Coming through the forest. It's a Funkasaurus coming through the forest. You can hear him because he got all that funky stuff hanging off him. You know where he's been. Out in the funk patch. You close your eyes, you can see. Got that big Funkasaurus trunkasaurus. Got the Funkasaurus trunkasaurus.
We've covered a lot of ground together, played all over the world, from Chicago to Shibuya, from Madison to Madrid. Moses Petru is my soul brother. This year, he released a new album called Confession of a Fool, produced by the great engineer, producer, and studio owner Ken Rich of Grand Street Recording in Brooklyn. And it's a record that he's been building toward his whole life. It's a deeply soulful statement that somehow sounds like the past and the present at the same time. I'm on a run day. Try to find my way back home. I'm on a run day. Try to find my way back home. I've been gone 7 days and counting. Pray that nothing ain't going on wrong. So we got together to trace that arc from his roots in hand drumming and hip-hop in Madison to his immersion in second line Brazilian and Cuban traditions to the house fire in Brooklyn that nearly ended everything and how it also marked the beginning of something new. We talked about how he really threw himself into playing organ during the pandemic, learning harmony the same way he had learned rhythm all those years before, by listening, by feeling, and by being in the music. Today, a lot of people in New York know Moses first as an organ player and a singer, but that transformation didn't come from school or a program. It came from life, from determination, and from a refusal to stop growing. Because he can't stop. He even named his sophomore record Can't Stop, Volume 1. I love that he named it Volume 1. Even if he never comes out with Volume 2, I still love that he named it Volume 1. So what we have here today is a portrait of an artist standing on the precipice, but also a sweet conversation between two old friends trying to make sense of what they've done together. And today, as I celebrate the 300th episode of The Third Story, I can't think of a better person to talk to than Moses Petru, my friend, my collaborator, and one of the reasons I found my way into this city and onto this scene all those years ago. As always, visit third-story.com to check out the archive. 300 episodes deep now, including memorable talks with drummers like Moses. Think Nate Smith, Dave Garibaldi, or Clyde Stubblefield. Or organ players like Moses. Think Corey Henry, Larry Goldings, or John Medeski. And singer-songwriters like Moses. Think Richard Julian, Joe Henry, or Raul Midon. The list goes on, and they're all there for you at third-story.com. You can also find me on Substack. It's leosidran.substack.com, where I post episodes, essays, and other news. And remember, The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for all their award-winning content. Here's me and Moses Petru talking it up and down. Moses Petru, I don't really know how to approach this one. I have to be honest. So I was thinking about how to get into this with you.
Yeah.
And I thought what I should say to you is, listening to your new record, Confessions of a Fool. One confession. Just a single
just
confession.
One. That's the thing, is I wanted to throw people through a ringer on that one. And it's proven to be kind of weird because everybody thinks it's confessions because that's normally what it is.
But he's just making one confession.
Just making one with this. You know why that is?
Why?
Because I didn't like the way it sounded in the song when I said Confessions of a Fool.
I still want to be in love. I want to be the one that you're thinking of. I still want to be in love. You. Confession of a Fool.
I love the title, and I like that you thought about it on that level, because I know you are a thoughtful person. But I just want to say to you, as somebody who has been in your corner since before you had four walls, that I think you made a perfect record, man.
Thank you. Wow.
You could not have made a better record. And it does a thing that you have been working towards for so long. It's classic sounding and it's traditional, but it doesn't sound like a corny throwback tribute record of any kind, you know? Yeah. And it's so hard to do that, to make music that really belongs to an era that I guess is not contemporary. But on the other hand, it still feels super contemporary and it still feels like today. Anyway.
That's what I was hoping for. Because I've heard a lot of recordings where they really want it to sound, you know, like from a different era.
Yeah.
And it's great. It serves a purpose, but I really wanted people to feel like there's some of that sentiment, but I don't want it to necessarily go all the way back to that.
Okay, so having said all that, Moses Petru, you and I We've been friends since high school.
Yep.
Do you remember when we first met?
Yeah, I think so. I think I called you.
You came over to my house with a conga drum.
Yeah.
And we just played two drums.
Right.
Jammed at my parents' house.
Yeah.
You just walked in grinning, let's play. Like
that was me.
It was the most normal thing in the world. And you just locked right in and we just started playing.
Yeah.
I don't know who it was that suggested that we should know each other. Both of our fathers are
musicians,
piano players, yeah. Kind of out of a similar mold, very different types of careers. But
yeah,
I mean, are you named Moses in some way in tribute to Mose Allison?
Yeah, I was named after Mose Allison. In fact, I have a record because he had went to see Mose Allison. He brought the record and he said, you know, he must have told him that he named his boy after him. And so Mose Allison wrote, you know, from one Mose to another on the record. I think we have that. He has the record. But that was his guy, and he, you know, at college age, you know, he was really into Moes. And he didn't go into the blues thing more. You know, he's also a guitar player. And I was born in Nashville, and he was doing that thing.
Where was your dad from?
From Illinois. Not too far from where your dad was born.
Oh, really?
Grew up Rockford area.
Oh, yeah.
So he was down in Nashville when I was born. He actually was playing bass in some pickup bands and stuff. And then not too long after I was born, he did some gigs up in Madison and he really liked it up there. I mean, we kind of all grew up around the same people in that area. So I think that's why you and I met, because everybody was like, oh yeah, you know, Ben's got a son your age. You know, all the older people would tell me.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, and I had heard about you like, you know, practically my whole life.
Your dad, so it's interesting. He was a guitar player and a bass player, but we knew him as Johnny Chimes. He plays piano,
right.
New Orleans-style piano player.
With his pseudonym. He was always a very private person.
Right.
And now he's writing songs under his own name, and he's releasing them on SoundCloud because he's tired of the thing. But, you know, he was always very private. I have some of that myself. I'm a little reserved sometimes, too. But I was always a little more outgoing than he was.
Well, when I found you in high school, you had already fallen in with this crew of people who, as far as I was concerned, were kind of the cool kids. You were in this band, Black Poet Society, that was like a live hip-hop band, basically.
Yeah, that was fun.
And you were having a great time, and you were just in it. I mean, I was in high school playing in bands and stuff, but mostly just doing my own thing at home, writing songs and just kind of nerding out on my little equipment that I had and stuff. But you came in and I could tell this is a guy that likes to play music, like to jam. We're gonna get together, we're just gonna play.
Yeah.
And you were a hand drummer.
Yeah.
I mean, that was your first thing that I knew you as.
Yeah.
You had developed interest in Brazilian music, Cuban music, and New Orleans music.
Yeah.
Just tell me what was going on that happened.
Well, I started out playing bass. I was playing with Jason Ewald back then. He was playing drums and another friend of ours. But I was really a bass player. And then I switched over to, I saw Michael Walls playing. I don't know if you remember Michael.
Yeah, basically.
Michael Walls was he played in a lot of different acts in town. He's a great player. And he was, you know, I saw him playing and I said, man, that's cool. I want to do that.
And he was playing hand drums?
He was playing hand drums. And he was smiling and the sun was on him. I think my dad took me and my friend to go to Milwaukee.
Hmm.
I was 14, maybe 15, and we went to see Alex Acuna. He was doing a clinic. You know, I mean, if you know Alex Acuna's weather report, you know, major player, super heavy dude, Peruvian guy. And so he's got all of this stuff. He's playing it, and he starts playing a box. He starts playing a cajon. And at that time in America, you'd never seen a cajon. It was none of this like you go to the coffee house and you got a guitar player and a cajon player. None of that stuff existed.
This is like 1990.
This is 90, yeah, 90, I would say
91,
92,
92, yeah.
Probably. So I said, well, what the hell? And he gets into this, you know, he starts getting into the depth of, you know, putting three against two, dealing with clave, dealing with, you know, a lot of syncopation, a lot of different stuff, a lot of African bell lines, a lot of different, you know, it's deep and it stuck.
And had you already been listening to a lot of New Orleans music at that point?
I had always been listening to New Orleans music because my dad was really into it. So first thing I ever heard in life was like Kansas City boogie woogie piano and New Orleans guys, long hair, Toots Washington, James Booker, Dr. John obviously was a big one. The Meters, and this is from young, So I'd always kind of heard that, and I always had, you know, but I always had other, a lot of music, you know. My mother had records too. It was like Sade and Steely Dan we had in the house, and there was the first record that I ever wore out was a Richard T record.
And were your parents ever together when you were growing up?
Yeah, they were together until I was 14.
Right at that time, around that same time that you heard Alex Acuna.
Yeah. That's when I needed music, because I was really rough. There was a point where it could have gone either way, and the music kind of bailed me out.
Right, and music was the home base, the safe place.
Yeah.
And where did you live then after they split up?
I moved down going north. My dad moved closer to the school because I was going to Shabazz.
Which was like the alternative high school.
Alternative.
Yeah.
And people always said it was the alternative to school. And then I said, no, it wasn't the alternative to school. It was a good school. And teachers, they're still in touch with, I still stay in touch with the teachers.
Yeah.
Really good teachers.
But I have to admit that when I met you, you did seem a lot more free range than I was. Like, you seemed like you, certainly by the time we were a little bit older, it felt like you could do whatever you wanted. Or
yeah,
you did whatever you wanted.
I had some freedoms. During the period of time that they were split, my dad was on the road a lot. And, you know, for better or for worse, there was a lot of freedom there. And I don't want to get in too deep into the details. But, yeah, I had lived a lot from about the time I was 14 to 17, 18.
Yeah.
I'd had some rough encounters. And, I also had some great things. But, like I said, the music and also the people that I met through the music was pretty incredible.
You know, this is something I don't think we ever talked about, but I grew up in a version of Madison that was very white. There was not a lot of black community around me when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And like, actually, most of the black people I knew were through music. And when I met you, you were tapped into a completely different version of the Madison community that I just, because of, I guess, where I was growing up or whatever, I just hadn't tapped into at all.
Mm.
And I've always felt that you had a much more like expansive view of what was in Madison in some ways than I did. You saw stuff and you found people that I would have never known to find.
I don't know what it was. There's a certain, I don't know if it's just was the area that I was or my disposition or if it was, you know, there's a lot of different, maybe a lot of different factors to it. But I think that I don't really know how that happened. It was like the scene that I was in. Like you said, I was in Black Poets Society. I was the only white boy in Black Poets Society. But it was natural, and it wasn't like Moses is like a brother. They said Moses is a brother. He's one of, I was a part of that crew and I was a part of that family. There was a band, it was, you know, all black kids and they're playing instruments and they're rapping. And so that had a certain, at the time, there was a certain excitement around that.
Yeah.
And we were all kind of a unit, and hip hop is very much a unit that is kind of inclusive.
That was the other thing, is when we met, you were in the hip hop community. I mean, that was your first music community in Madison, was the hip hop community.
Yeah, it's true.
It's funny looking back on that now.
Yeah.
Because as you get older and older, you make music that sounds like it's from longer and longer ago in a way.
Yeah, but
you know?
If you think about, where does hip hop come from?
Yeah.
I mean, hip hop, the sampling of hip hop came from all the records that I'm basically trying to
sound like
or bring back, or at least
reference
when I'm in my music. So in essence, it's not too far removed. You know, if you think, we grew up in a town where Clyde Stubblefield was playing gigs, and we used to sit outside of King's Club or the Chamber because we couldn't get in. We would watch him playing from the window, and he'd laugh at us, point, and he'd say, come in here, and they wouldn't let us in.
Yeah.
But we were out there.
But the interesting thing I always thought about watching Clyde Stubblefield play all those years is that he was playing the blues.
Yeah, well, that's it. And the first time I saw a singing drummer was seeing Clyde play and sing.
Yeah.
And so when I started playing drums and singing, it seemed like, well, that's what people do. You can do that.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, I never thought about it as like, this is hard, I just start singing.
Yeah. Well, that's a very deep thing also that we'll get to. But I think the way groove, when you're a songwriter and you play drums, I think so much of it comes from the bottom up. Like, even when you and I worked together, it would always be, here's a song and this is the beat. Like, you know, you'd come in and be like, it's this. This is the beat and this is how the song goes on top of this beat.
Right.
But they had evolved together.
Right.
You were thinking that way for a long time.
I think so, because I was thinking as a drummer. I was coming from percussion and I was coming from, you know, all this different thing. So I used to think about the drum beat now I'm still concerned about the rhythm and the feel, but I'm not as concerned about the particular beats of the kick drum. And maybe that's just because when I'm playing more organ now.
I think about that too. Like when you were playing drums on your records, then the beat became very important to you. And are you playing drums on this record?
I played on two songs on this record, and the rest of it I gave it to Diego to play.
God, he sounds so good.
Yeah, he's great.
But so when you let go of it, it's like, okay, I don't need to dictate the exact beat then, you know?
You know, you can't. Yeah. Because I don't think you're going to get the performance out of people that you want by dictating what they play.
Yeah. So the other thing that happened, though, was there was another crew of people in Madison that were into Brazilian music, hanging out on the Library Mall.
Yeah.
And you fell in with that crew also.
Yeah.
The Amphibians and the...
Yeah, so I started that. Well, I was one of the members of that group. There was a guy by the name of Matt Rappaport. Going back to talking about Michael Walls, I had taken a lesson with Michael, and it was cool. But Michael was like dealing with stuff, and he couldn't, you know, he wasn't really a teacher. He didn't want to teach. He was getting, and I had sat in on his classes where he was teaching, you know, like 20 people, and teaching them how to play the congas, and they're all in a circle, a drum circle, and he hands me the two sticks. He hands me the clave, and they're dak dak dak, you know, and I'm playing, just sitting that for an hour. And if I drop the clave, he got on my case so bad one time.
Did you recognize when he showed you the clave, oh, this is the same thing that runs through the music that my dad listens to, that this is the same thing from New Orleans?
I didn't even think about all that. But when I played it, I knew I could play it.
Yeah.
But I didn't make any correlations. The correlation didn't come until later. All of that stuff was connected. When I started traveling more... Because that's still when I was young, and it was real informative, and everything was new, and everything was exciting, you know, and learning how to play percussion. But anyway, he was like, well, why don't you go and play with these guys? There's some guys in town that are playing in these different bands, and they're really into this stuff. And this guy had just got back from West Africa, and he was into sabar, and he was into djembe, and he was doing all this different stuff. So I said, all right, well, let me go and take a lesson with this guy. So I took one lesson with him. Paid him like $30 mm-hmm. or something. And he showed me an African bell line. He showed me that. And after that, he was a block away from where I was living at the time. So I just used to like show up, you know, and see, because he was playing in a local band. So he was like, he's about 5 years, maybe 7 years, 7 years older than me.
Yeah.
And he ended up becoming like a big brother or something, you know, to me. Matt Rappaport.
Oh, yeah.
Great player, great dude. We were supposed to go to Brazil, but he had some issues. He couldn't go. He was supposed to go with us when I went. I went to Brazil in 97. I was 19, and I was there for 3 months.
Wow.
During Carnival.
See, this is what I'm talking about. Like, you're 19, and you took yourself to Brazil, and you went to Cuba at some point, too.
I went to Cuba to
hang with Roberto Vizcaino. And...
Right, but I met all these people that I met because they were being brought by
Willie Ney,
the different program directors at the University of Wisconsin. Yeah. And at the time, I wasn't enrolled in college.
Did you ever enroll in college there?
No. I did Spanish and I did music theory at
MATC. We had this parallel trajectory the whole time because I stayed in Madison for college and you were there. I have this memory of you being a part of my whole college experience, even though I sort of got the sense you weren't in college.
No.
I mean, you were working it out on your own time and in your own way. You were definitely
And they, all of those learning. Guys, Willie and all those guys wanted me to, they were always like, you should go to college, you should do this. And I was like, you know, who's paying for it?
Yeah.
Are you paying for it?
Yeah.
We didn't have that conversation at the end of my high school because, you know, my teachers were pushing for me to get done, but I was a struggle. I was a real, they didn't
like you up. Almost didn't get through.
Yeah, they didn't give up on me. And that's the thing is because, again, I was going through and I wasn't like strung out or something, but I was just a knucklehead. I wasn't really part of that indoctrination of, you know, the 9-to-5 thing, you know, not to say that it's an, you know, like I'm not giving it against anybody who does that life, but it's just like I knew that I was going to do what I was going to do.
What I think is interesting about that is that in the last, well, certainly since you got to New York, but I would even say in the last, you know, 15 years or something, I've seen you take basically what you always did, which is just throw yourself into the music.
Yeah.
And craft it into a profession. You know what I mean? Because I see what you do now as very serious. Like, I think you take it seriously. Mm-hmm. Maybe the best example of that is when, after years and years of working essentially as a percussion player and a drummer who also wrote songs, you just quietly determined that you were going to become an organ player. And you did it. And there's all these people in New York who think of you as an organ player. I mean, you are an organ player, but it's a thing that you willed into existence through all I can imagine is this very self-motivated work. And when I look back all the way back to in college, where it might have looked like, even to me, like I wasn't sure if how serious you were going to take this.
Yeah.
You know, you were kind of running around and playing gigs and, you know, you were in a lot of bands and, you know, you're having a good time. And, but that, all of what you put together in that period of your life served you, I think, later on when it was like, oh, I need to be serious about this.
Yeah.
And this is my job.
Yeah. I always knew that the piano and the keyboard was essential, you know, and the guitar too. And I still play the guitar all the time, but I don't play it out. But I always thought that that was the thing that was going to allow me to craft the songs, because I always had the song. Even before, I remember as a young kid, I would walk home from the school bus and I was singing melodies and stuff. And I said, well, I don't know what that song is. And I was young. So I always had song in my head.
Yeah.
But I knew that the only way that I was going to be able to get it out is if I learned how to play the piano and I learned how to play the bass. I learned how to play the guitar. And so also the other thing about the organ, interesting enough, is because the way my dad plays, he's a solo pianist. He played as a solo pianist his whole life. So his left hand is all bass all the time.
It's like my dad.
Right. And your dad plays organ too.
Yeah.
But your dad can chord. I've heard him where he's chording in the middle. My dad didn't start doing that until the last like 15 years. Maybe, you know.
So it'll be a bass in the left hand.
And he's solo, chording in the middle.
Yeah.
And then he'll solo a little bit and then he'll chord. Yeah. He basically plays like an organ player.
Yeah.
But he's scared of the organ. He's like, all those, you know, draw bars. Yeah. I said, you'd be a killing organ player if you just played it. My point is that when I figured out that the organ, I had already been kind of predispositioned to play the organ all along.
The way you play piano.
The way I play piano.
Yeah.
Because it's a sense of like, and if you think about all of the, like Jimmy McGriff's story, when I was listening to him talk one time, and he started out, he was playing boogie woogie.
Yeah.
Piano.
Sure.
He didn't start out playing gospel music or, you know, I mean, he heard gospel music, but he started out, he was really into boogie woogie, like boom, left hand going, you know? And all of that stuff is basically the transition from the piano to the organ. It's like a direct descendant of boogie woogie.
I see that. Sure. My dad started as playing boogie woogie too. And that's why he said he could play organ, because you're playing bass lines in your left hand.
Yeah. And not only that, but you're not thinking about your left hand.
Yeah.
The idea is that it's kind of a set it and forget it concept.
Yeah.
In boogie woogie, you're not thinking about your left hand.
Yeah.
You're thinking about the flow of the right hand.
Yeah.
Same thing with the organ. You're not thinking about the bass line. Once your hand gets accustomed to playing those walks, you know, that's the point where you're trying to get to, is where your left hand is like its own person.
So I want to touch on a couple of things. We're still stuck in Madison and we got so much to cover, but you also put these New Orleans bands together. You had this Mama Dig Downs. I got a new baby. I got a new baby.
I got a new girl. Finally got a piece of mind. Yeah, Mama Dig Downs, they hired me when I was young after I had gotten back from Brazil. Mama Dig Downs, I was 19, and I started learning how to play bass drum with them. And then they started taking me down to New Orleans. And I was already familiar with New Orleans music to a point, like Alan Toussaint, listening to these records. I wasn't ready for the type of exposure that we were going into.
So what did you guys experience when you went down to New Orleans? Because it feels like it really affected you.
Well, we were the only outsiders to come into that brass band community essentially, and be able and be kind of accepted. We were accepted there. Mama Dig Down, so that was Eric Jacobson, Rock Oli. Those two, they were so cool. This was in 90, 95, 96, 97. At the time, New Orleans was in a brass band kind of renaissance period. A lot of young bands. You know, it was Rebirth, of course. The Soul Rebels was a young, fresh band. It was killing. Hot Eight were just babies. And so Youngblood was the second band that I joined as an offshoot of Mama Dig Down's. Hot Eight and Youngblood were kind of like the young, we had a bond.
Yeah.
We had a real close bond. And it got so deep because, you know, just if you go to a Second Line Parade or you go into, you're just around that music,
yeah.
and you play with those players, they were so beautiful, man. They were so gracious. And we were all the same age and we were all like, it was like family. They treated you, they just treated us so good.
All of this is painting a really interesting picture of this exploration in your musical background that was Brazil, New Orleans,
yeah.
Cuba,
yeah.
Hip-hop.
Yeah.
I mean, you were soaking all that stuff in at the same time.
Yeah.
And playing drums in your dad's band.
And all in a place like Madison, Wisconsin.
I mean, when you describe it to me, it makes me think like, well...
It's like the Twilight Zone. It's like a whole different... how did that happen? But it happened.
And then were you working with Hanat? Were you playing with Hanat too?
I played with Hanat.
Hanat John Taylor, who was a saxophone player from Chicago, who got to Madison.
Vincent Davis.
Oh, yeah.
Alongside Vincent Davis, who was just a monster drummer, left-hand drummer, scary.
Somewhere along the way, you got your hands on a four-track cassette player.
My dad had one. He had a Tascam four-track in mint condition, and I'd get the cassette tapes from Full Compass.
Of course.
Down the road from I was living in Middleton.
Yeah.
And I had a
some kind of drum machine.
Alesis drum machine. Yeah. Was it Alesis?
Yep.
Drum machine. And I had the keyboard, my dad's keyboard. It had a little organ sound on it. And I had a bass and I had a guitar. And I had an acoustic. And it was all basically his stuff. But the drum machine was mine. I took that one over.
So here's what I know. I know that you called me. I don't know. We must have been hanging out a little bit or something. I'm not sure why you called me.
Yeah.
And you said, I need to play you something.
Yeah.
And you came over to my apartment.
Yeah. You were living over downtown.
Above Cafe Momar.
Right.
You play me this cassette tape of a song that you had written.
Yeah.
Called Feel This Funk.
Yeah.
It was the first thing I had heard of yours that wasn't you playing with the band.
Right.
And it was really cool sounding. It had a lot of personality and a lot of stuff happening.
Yeah. I'm rocking till I make your body feel this funk. Sing it. Rocking till I make your body feel this funk. Gonna roll it till I make your body feel this funk. Gonna roll it till I make your body feel this funk.
Kind of was the first version of you starting to combine all of this stuff that you had been doing. I mean, I really, for the longest time, I could not figure out where the downbeat was, where one was in the two.
Yeah, because I didn't put a snare on it.
I couldn't hear it.
It was moving like a brass band song.
And you had this vocal thing and the way you EQ'd your vocal.
Doing it to you, mama.
And I freaked out. I freaked out.
I remember.
Do you remember what happened?
I remember. You called Ben.
I called my dad. It's like 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah. This was before, you know, you could send it in an email or something, you know.
No, you had to have, you brought the cassette to my house.
I brought the cassette to your place. I bounced it and I brought it probably the next day or something. I just mixed it. I said, you know, who's got to hear this? Because I knew that you, you know, were involved in a lot of music and a lot of legit music, like, you know, on the scene. And I said, you got to hear this tune.
And how right you were. So you brought it over to me.
Brought it over.
I freak out. I call my dad. He's in bed. But I say to him, you need to come over here right now.
Yeah.
He lived a couple miles away.
Yeah.
He gets in the car and comes over.
Yeah.
Now it's the three of us.
Yeah, and I was shocked by that because I think that was the first time that I actually really met your dad.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he comes over.
And we just listened to it over and over again.
Yeah. And he knew right where one is at.
He did. He knew where it was. He knew where one was.
He knew where one was.
After that, we started working.
We started working.
I was like, I want to produce this with you. And so we didn't do that tune. We did two other tunes.
Yeah.
When you still lived in Madison.
Yeah.
My parents' attic.
Yep.
We did Soul Saturday.
Yep. Do you really want to get on down? Or do you really want to get on down? Do you really want to get on down? Or do you really want to get on down? Do you really want to get on down? Or do you really want to get on down? Baby, do you want to get on down? Or do you really want to get on down?
And we did You Don't Take Me Serious.
Yep.
And I'll tell you, I mean, this is how long ago it was when you think about where you're at on the piano. You could play the tune.
In the key that it
And was. You could play the bridge, but when it modulated,
I
had to play the last chorus of it because it was in a new key.
Yeah.
You know, you knew that you wanted it to go up a half step, but once it got there, it was like, I don't have that.
I don't have it. It didn't have. And the thing is, I didn't have time to work it out. We had started working on the tune, so it was like, we're going.
Yeah.
But you had enough know-how in the music, so that was another thing why we, you know, we worked well together. Why must it be this way? Hot and cold like night and day, yeah. All in all, in all, in all, might have caught your fall, but you didn't ever be the same way. 'Cause you don't take me serious at all. You could see what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
And that you could finish the statement. And that's kind of still, I still defer.
Yeah.
If I'm working with you, you know, on a producing something, I still defer.
Because I think that
everybody has, you know, the input and everybody has something that, and I think once you get into the flow of a song, you know, that you kind of have to let everybody, you know.
But also, I think because your music is pulling from so much language, so much vocabulary, that we kind of all have. I mean, some more than others, but I think when you find a musician who understands where you're coming from, you don't have to say that much to them. They,
right.
I mean, I even see, like, when I watched you play the other day at the Bitter End for your album release show, I was thinking, and I saw you pull out tunes that the band didn't know.
Yeah.
And it's like, boy, you figured out how to write songs that are original and also that you, not that you can see them coming, but once you see them one time, you get it.
Right.
It's like they all have a little twist in them. There's a thing. It sits on the five chord for an extra two bars or it does a thing or whatever. But it's like it's using the vocabulary of music that everybody on that stage knows.
Right. You want people to feel like familiar with the music. You want them to feel, you want a listener, you want them to feel like, because they don't know the song. It's a new song.
Yeah.
But you want them to feel like it's familiar enough.
Yeah.
That by the second time around, they hear it, that they feel like they know the song.
Yes.
And that's not only the musicians, it's everybody in the audience. You want people, I think, that's how I think about music.
Sure. And I think lyrically, that's how you approach it too. Like you're clever, but also it's like you also write songs where, and I try to do this too, and I think Mose did this, and I think my dad does this, and I think a lot of the songwriters that we love the most do this. Write songs where you go, wait, nobody wrote that yet?
Yeah.
Really? That one hasn't been written yet? You know? Like, I can't believe that. Like, that should have been written already. Like, it seems so clear that that should be here. You know? Like, you've written a lot of songs on this record. There's a lot of songs that just seem like, can't believe that didn't exist already.
Wow. That's a compliment, man. You know, all of it, it's like, I wouldn't say, like, the derivative.
Yeah.
But
it's a fine line.
It's a fine line, because if you think about it, all of this stuff comes from the language that, like you're talking about, all the different language and all the different music and all the different processes
yeah.
that you go through as a songwriter and the types, you know. So if you hear a lot of blues, you hear a lot of country, you hear a lot of jazz, whatever types of music,
yeah.
it has to filter through your experience.
Yeah. And I will say, you always, certainly by the time you got to New York, knew how to channel the blues in a way that I would never attempt to do. My dad is happy to talk about the blues as a reality. You could talk about, like, I think about the song that you wrote with Jay Collins, Rock Bottom.
Yeah.
Blues walked in, blew my curtains in. What is
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's Jay. Jay wrote that line.
That's his line. Blues,
you know.
You helped him write that song.
I started writing that song. You know, Jay went through, you know, yeah. some hard time. And I kind of wrote that song for him to help him out of that thing.
Yeah.
And to help him kind of take a look at things. And, you know, he made it out. So I wrote the first verse on that song. And I wrote the head. And he actually came in and said, well, that's, you should actually start.
Uh-huh.
You should start the chorus. You should start that on the two.
I hit rock bottom. Then I got up.
He kind of helped me with the actual thing. So yeah. I said, all right, well, he's already kind of doing this. Why don't you write a verse?
Uh-huh.
So he wrote the second verse.
Stuck in bed one more day. Getting tired of the same old way. I was tired. Of pushing shove, yeah. And I was tired of this foolish love. Different streets all look the same. When you're standing in the pouring rain, blues came by, blew my curtains in. I was down, but now I'm back again.
Somebody else covered that song. Last year, Glenn David Andrews down in New Orleans heard that song, who I had actually seen Glenn from back in when I was going down to New Orleans, you know, spending all that time down in New Orleans. I saw Glenn when he was a kid because I knew, you know, his cousin Iron was a good friend of mine, you know, all the guys in Hot Eight. So all and that's and he's, you know, related to Trombone Shorty. That's his cousin. And so I had seen all those guys. So when I told him that. The song that you're playing, that's my tune, and I've known you since we were yeah. kids. He freaked out, but he said that second verse that Jay wrote,
yeah.
it took him out. I mean, because it was coming from Jay's perspective
yeah.
of what it's really like to go through a substance thing
yeah.
and come out on the other side.
Yes. The acknowledgement and reality of the blues as a fact of life is just something that you were willing to go towards that a lot of people don't necessarily understand. And, you know, I think that not dwelling in it too much, but what you describe in adolescence of number one, the rupture of your parents, you know, yeah. and you being kind of thrust out into the world sure. and discovering music. I think you did discover the blues on a legitimate level that you understood when you heard those lyrics. Like, I know what they're talking about. This is not...
Sure.
pretend. So you moved to New York.
Yeah.
We had started working together, you and me, in my parents' yeah. attic. We had a couple of tunes under our belts. And then you moved here in 2001.
Yeah.
Did you move for any particular reason? Did your friends move
well,
here?
Well, I was considering moving to New Orleans.
Yeah.
But I had gotten a call from my friend, yeah, Urell called me and I had visited him here and he lived in Brooklyn. This was before Brooklyn was on t-shirts and stuff.
Yeah. And you were like about 24, 25 when you moved here?
Yeah. Yeah. I was 24. He said, I got a place. Jay Collins, him and his wife just split up and they got an extra room downtown, pays $400 a month to live in Dumbo. which is, you know, now is like $4,000 a month. Yeah. You know, you're one stop away from the city, you know, two blocks from the train, $400 a month. And I got a gig, you know, he had a gig for me teaching, because I had always kind of been teaching kids. Even when I was in Madison, I was teaching on the south side of Madison. I was teaching at a Lincoln school. I had a program there that this lady got me in to teach these kids. So I had a little group of kids. So I had some experience teaching music and percussion. So Urell hired me to teach. I was teaching 4 days a week. I was teaching in, you know, East New York. I was teaching in Harlem, East Harlem, the Bronx. I was all over the place. I did that for a lot of years.
Yes, you did.
A lot of years I was teaching.
So you land in this apartment, yeah, in a room in an apartment that Jay Collins had in Dumbo.
Yeah.
Is that the place?
That's the place. That was a hotbed of musicians in that neighborhood at the time.
And in that house?
In that house alone.
So you're living with Jay Collins, a saxophone player.
And then Brazilian Girls was upstairs, the band Brazilian Girls. That was Jesse Murphy and Aaron Johnston. And then below me was Marlon Broden, who was playing with Vernon Reed at the time. And they were all incredible musicians. And you'd be practicing and I would just be like self-conscious and shit. You know, you'd be nervous to practice at home because they were just, you know, they're just monsters. And I was still green.
And you move here and within a couple months, 9/11 happens.
9/11 happened 10 days after I moved in.
So welcome to New York.
Yeah. I saw 9/11 from the rooftop of the building.
Yeah.
Jesse woke me up and said, come on. I climbed out on the roof. You know, I was already just woke up and I didn't drink any coffee. I wasn't drinking coffee at the time. But I woke up and I'm on the emergency exit ladder climbing up on top of the building to see the second tower fall. That was a scary time.
So you got here with basically, you knew musicians, you were playing drums, you were teaching hand drums, you were just picking up gigs however you could.
Yeah.
And
I was teaching more than not, but I was playing some gigs with Jay. And I was playing at 55 Bar.
With Jay.
I started my brass band, the Sugar Tone Brass Band.
So you did what you knew how to do.
Right.
You came, played drums, put a brass band together, taught drums, got yourself out in front of people as much as you could.
Right.
Now, one interesting thing about that place that you lived is that eventually there was a fire in that house.
Yeah.
Tell me this story.
Oh, wow. I was out on the road with Youngblood. We were in Europe. Everybody was on tour at that time. Jay was out with Greg Allman. He was the music director for Greg Allman at the time. Jesse Murphy was out. The Brazilian Girls was out on tour. Marlon was out on tour. Everybody was out. There was two people staying down there, like always somebody there occupying the place.
I remember, by the way, you had moved to New York. And Jesse Murphy came through Madison playing with John Scofield with Uber Jam with Adam Deitch and Avi Bortnick. And you must have said to me, oh, my roommate is out with Scofield or whatever. And so like that was one of the first moments I understood that you must have found some kind of great scene in New York because my roommate's going to come. He's on tour with John Scofield. And he came down to our jam session at the King Club and he sat and we were talking about you. And I was like, what did Moses get himself into that this is who he lives with?
Yeah.
You know, it was just like the baddest.
You know, I tell you what, man, I have always, the first time I showed up in LA, I was 18 years old and I went to Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles.
Yeah.
And you know who I met? Beyonce and Kelly. When I was on my way down to Brazil, who's the first person I met on the plane with me from Sao Paulo to Salvador? Gilberto Gil.
No.
Yeah. He signed my notebook. He said, up to the music. That's what I said. I just always happen to be, I don't know what it is.
Yeah. But you feel that.
But I always feel like I show up.
Yeah.
And I'm like on time somewhere.
Yeah. So you landed on time in this place. Okay. Now everybody's on the road. And you're going to tell the story about the fire.
Everybody's on the road. I'm on the road. It was a brutal tour. You know, we went to Germany. I got food poisoning from the food they fed us before the gig. Mm. And we're driving after the gig. Me and one other guy had eaten the same thing, maybe. And we're basically pulling over the van. We're just like losing it. And I'm passing out in the back of the van. And then finally we get to the airport. You know, before then I bought two big bottles of Gatorade and I slammed those. We get on an airplane and we go to Canary Islands to do one night. Canary Islands, you show up, do the gig, go to sleep, wake up and leave, and then go to Belgium. Mm-hmm. And that was how the whole tour was. Just brutal.
Oof.
Brutal tour. And you're young and you're stupid and you're doing like, and you're not sleeping and you're, you know. And then on top of that, you're getting food poisoning. Yeah. And so at the end of that, I'm coming home and I'm like, finally, I'm going to get to sleep. I'm going to get some rest. So I show up. My girlfriend, my wife now, she picks me up at the airport, come home, bag still packed, come back to the apartment. You know, I fall out immediately. She wakes me up like 2 hours later. Wake up, there's something going on upstairs. And I don't know what the fuck, what's going on. Like shit is breaking. Like there's glass breaking. So I go, what the hell? So I stand up, I flip on the light. You know, the bed's right here, ceiling's right here. The smoke is like somewhere in between. You know, the room upstairs from Jesse's room caught on fire.
Mm. From a lamp?
I think a surge protector is what they said.
Really?
Surge protector. Okay. Not a smoke detector in the whole place. There was one on the bottom floor.
Not a smoke detector in the whole place.
It's Brooklyn. And you know, it's a slumlord classic.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I'd been telling, I told him about the electric in the place anyway. But the smoke detector on the bottom floor as we were leaving, I grabbed my suitcase.
Yeah.
That was the only thing that...
Yeah, what'd you get out of the place before you left?
Well, everything was smoke damage and water damage.
Yeah.
Because they kicked in, the fire department came, since it was right above my room, they kicked in my window and they hosed everything. So I lost everything that was in my room. I lost my clothes, my computer, my keyboard, you know, and I worked hard for all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I paid for everything, but my drums were in the living room. My congas and my hardware, all my other stuff was, you know, so some of my stuff was cool.
So actually your floor was damaged, but upstairs was less damaged?
Upstairs was fried.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, Murphy said when I went up there, he said, you know, if you go up, and I never went into that room, but he said, if you go into my room, you'll have a new appreciation for your life.
Mm.
And he's right, because the thing was, is that, you know, had my wife not been there, you know, I probably would have, I would have been done. That would have been it, you know, so... That changed me, and I was really bad for a while. That was, talk about blues, that was the real blues. I went through something after that.
When was that?
That was 2007. That was the time that we finished that record.
No, it was before that. I moved here in 2005. You were already out of that house. See, I think it was in 2004 that happened.
Oh, 2004, you're right. 2004, you're right.
Because I moved here in 2005. We had started working together a few years earlier on those tunes. And when I got here, I didn't have anything going on.
Yeah.
I didn't really know that many people.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew that I wanted to produce and get into stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I called you not because I thought it was like an opportunity to whatever network. It was just like, oh, we started that music and it was cool and I don't have anything happening, so let's working on it.
Yeah.
And you, I remember... told me about the fire, and also like there was all this communal goodwill around you having gone through that.
Yeah.
And so my memory was we picked it up again and we started doing new tunes, and every time we would do a new tune it would be like, oh, my friend is going to come over and play guitar solo, his name is Chris Bergson.
Don't say goodbye.
Oh, my friend Tim Lunsell is going to come play bass.
Not gonna see you at all, no. World could be so small. Yeah.
Oh, Jesse Murphy is going to come play bass on this. Amy Helm is going to come sing on this.
Baby, don't you lose your focus. Baby, don't you lose your focus. Baby, don't you lose your focus. Baby, if you lose your focus, just don't put it on some other man.
Everybody you introduced me to
was
just the greatest, you know, players, and you had found them in that period.
Yeah.
And I always felt that part of, you know, they loved you, and also that there was this understanding that you had been through something with the community and the scene, certainly with the musicians in that house. Jay Collins was very active in your life at that time.
Yeah, and he was on the record and so forth. You know, I think that period of time, that was a real struggle. And, you know, I came out on the other side of that. I didn't really realize how like the same thing they say about actors, you know, the actors, normal people go out to Hollywood to act like they're big, and big people come to New York to act like they're regular.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everybody in New York is like, they're tremendous players. They're great players, but they're also just kind of trying to make music and make a living.
And survive.
And survive. No matter how good you are, a gig is a gig. You know, you got a good gig, you make $100,000, you go on a tour, you get, and then you don't get called for the next tour.
Yeah.
You know, so we all deal with that reality.
And a gig is a real equalizer too. Like, you know, you've over the last handful of years, actually more when you became an organ player, found yourself working with people who I would be afraid to call.
I was afraid to call them too.
You know, from Tony Scher to Ed Cherry to, you know, and it's like, oh, these players. But once you get on the bandstand,
right,
it's democratic.
Right.
It's, we're playing music.
Yeah.
And whoever you've played with before doesn't matter.
Right.
Whatever gig you got called for before doesn't matter.
Right.
Whatever you're having come up tomorrow doesn't matter. What matters is what we're doing right now.
All of those players are, like you said, when it's democratic, it really is. All of those players are there to make good music.
Yep.
So they're going to try to bring out the best in you because that's their job. Again, they understand the assignment. I think you become a better player the more that you play with these types of players. Everybody has their path, right? And I think that there is no, for everybody, you think that you know what your path is, but you don't know.
Yeah.
You start here
and
all this other stuff happens and then this is where you end up.
Yeah.
But you're not in control of any of that.
Yeah.
You're going to go through something.
Yeah.
If you stay playing music or if you just stay doing whatever you do, you know, I just don't see, because we're not even the same person we were 5 years ago.
You taught me that. You shed your skin every 7 years.
You do. You absolutely do. I think of the time before COVID. When we went through COVID, COVID was like, I was telling my wife last night, it was like the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
You know, it really, I think it was for a lot of people, but it was like, I feel like I was that person before COVID.
Yeah.
And the time that I spent during COVID up till now, I'm a completely different person.
In what sense?
In the sense that I said, well, I know I need to commit my time to learning, firstly, how to play the organ, like really play it. I'm going to take this time. I'm going to learn how to play this. I'm going to learn all the stuff that people are learning in school. I'm going to try to teach myself, you know, by using
YouTube and your ears. YouTube
and using all the musicians that I know to say, oh, show me that. What's that? And the musicians I hang up, you know, they have no filter. They'll just tell you, no, that ain't right.
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Yeah.
Do this.
Yeah.
And then you're like, okay, great. And then you fix it and that's it. And so I spent all of my time, I used that, you know, I was watching Barry Harris videos. I was listening to, you know, Jimmy Smith. I was listening to, you know, Stanley Turrentine. Yeah. I was listening to whoever. I was listening. Music, it's about listening. It's not analyzing. You just listen.
Yeah, that's right.
You listen and you feel.
That's right.
And you don't study. You just feel. Does that make sense?
So much. You listen.
You listen.
The information is in the music.
Right.
Listen to the music.
I saw Duke Ellington said something like that.
Yeah.
I just saw it.
So we're running around in circles here. Sure. What was it, Jay's tune?
Running in a circle, but you're going nowhere fast.
Love that song. That's a little bit like your song, Better Get It Right the First Time.
Better Get It Right. Better get it right the first time. Better get it right. Better get it right the first time.
Jay Collins had this tune, Running in a Circle, But You're Really Going Nowhere Fast. And you were playing in Jay Collins' band. When I moved here in 2005, I would go out and hear you play. You're playing conga with him. It would be Dred Scott and Diego Voglino and Lunsell. And
Sherrard was playing guitar for a while.
Sherrard and Chris also, Bergson, I saw
Chris
him play.
Chris Bergson too.
And Amy sang sometimes, Amy Helm and you.
And a great band.
It was a killer band, and it was just at that time, I mean, that's also that period where it was like post-Norah Jones, Blue Note, Verve, these labels were out kind of looking for kind of jazz, R&B, crossover projects, and it was exciting. And yeah. Living Room, and you know,
well, it was like the last. It was the end of the music business.
Yeah,
as far as I was concerned, that was Nora. Was she got in the gate? Her and John Mayer, and yeah. got in the gate just before it closed.
So there were A&R people and managers right. and stuff, you know, and you and I made what became your first record. It took us, in the end, it took a long time because we had started it in Madison, and then yeah. we picked it up in my apartment over here, and then when I got that gig at a music company in Tribeca, then we finished it at Amber in Tribeca, and yeah. a bunch of people played on it, and it was exciting. It's interesting listening to it back today because it's all over the place. It's Afro-Caribbean, and it's R&B, and it's jazz, yeah. and it's funky, and it's New Orleans, and it's like, it's all that stuff. I mean, I remember, I thought we were going to call it Music from the Land of the Good Groove.
Yeah.
And that's why I just love that you've got this tune
yeah.
called Take Me Back to the Land of the Good Groove.
Yeah, Land of the Good Groove.
I want to be back in the land of the good groove. Yeah. I want to be back where women know how to move.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I thought we talked about back then that I remember us talking about was that the record that we made, which really was made by two drummers who wrote songs and yeah. produced tracks, like that, there was a lot of rhythm
yeah.
inside that yeah, record. Yeah, yeah. And it was going to thread the line from Brazil through Cuba, through New Orleans, to Chicago. Like, that was my sense of what that record was doing.
Yeah,
it's, I mean, like music wherever Clave went.
Wherever Clave went.
That's what I felt like we were doing. And I'm so proud of that record.
Yeah.
You know, so, but then that came out in 2007 or something. But then it's like another 5 or 6 years before you make another record. And I realized the next record that you made, you're still playing drums on it.
Yeah.
Like, I checked it out, and it's Ben Stivers playing organ yep. and Jeff Hanley, and yep. you were still playing drums. So because yep. it hadn't, COVID hadn't happened, you hadn't no. done that thing yet. You hadn't transformed yourself yet.
Yeah, I think you're right. I might have played some keyboard on the stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I played on, like, Everybody Wants Everything I played. Yeah. There were some tracks that I yeah. played. We used demo.
Yeah.
Somebody got that song.
Funny, when I listen to your records and I think about all the times that I've seen you over the years, when you come over or we're sitting near a piano and you always have a tune and you're yeah. always like, check this out.
I got a new one.
You got one?
I've been working on one.
Yeah. I'll play you one too. I got one for you too.
You're the same way.
Oh yeah, totally. So I was trying to hear you as if for the first time today. And one of the things I think is, like, I think that you're telling the truth even when you're lying.
I don't think that music has to be autobiography.
Yeah.
I think that you play a series of chords.
Yeah.
And then let the colors of that chord tell the story.
Mm.
What is that? What are those series of chords saying to
yeah.
you? Because I know that you ain't mine on this record. My wife was like, why the hell did you write that
yeah.
song?
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know. But that song, that's what that song wanted to say.
Yeah.
And so I didn't necessarily, I was going to catch real heat. I was catching heat for that song.
Yeah.
It's kind of scandalous.
That you ain't mine, won't you hold me just one more time? Hold me, turn the lamp down low, won't you hold me? And please don't go.
Well, who's it going to be?
Who's it going to be?
Who's it going to be?
We're talking about blues themes. If it ain't me, who's it going to be tonight? Honey, if it's true, what am I to do with my mind?
What I like is, if it ain't me, who's it going to be tonight? I felt like when I was listening to that today, I was like, I just want to, like, listen to that as I walk out, because that could apply to anything. It's such a simple thing, and yet it's so true. You hear it goes, yeah, so true. But I don't even know what we're talking about.
No.
But I know that it's true.
It's just themes.
If
It's just themes, it's storytelling. It doesn't have to, like, again, you know, I think that that's the beauty of you.
Yeah.
It's like if you write a movie,
yeah,
if you're telling a story, it doesn't have to be your story.
Yeah.
But it could just be a story. But it's coming through your experience.
Every person has a different way of understanding what it is to be alive and get through this.
Sure.
And that's what the filter is.
Yes.
Your experience. I would never write Lost My Job. What is it? I lost my job.
I got fired from my job. Saved some money. I got robbed.
I got robbed.
Ain't no other way to say it. I'm like a song that just got played.
It's beautiful.
I got fired from my job. Saved some money. I got robbed. Ain't no other way to say it. I'm like a song just got played. I get tired, weary-eyed, need some loving, can't get the time. Ain't no other way around it, babe. I'm just like a picnic on a cloudy day. But as sure as the sun gonna shine someday.
I've loved watching as you play these clubs, and I'm amazed when I talk to you how much you work. You really work a lot, and you found a way to operate in New York and find out how to do what you want to do,
yeah,
and get paid to do it. But I think that there's still a lot of people who don't know who you are.
Yeah.
The musicians know who you are.
Yeah, musicians know.
That started happening, and that's a really good sign when the musicians start going, you know who's, check this out.
Yeah.
Check out Moses. And you played a lot of gigs with a lot of cats.
Yeah.
But I've been saying to you for the last few years when we talk about, well, what's the strategy here? How do you, okay, now I'm 35, now I'm 40, now I'm 45. How am I going to get discovered internationally,
yeah,
at 45 years old,
yeah,
coming on 50 years old,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
making this record that is as good as any record ever needs to sound,
yeah,
and yet you're looking at 50,
yeah,
and you're trying to get discovered.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we speak today, there's some good news about the album charting in Europe. And the two things I feel for you are, one, I definitely think Europe is going to be the place for you.
Yeah.
And the other is start acting old as soon as possible. Because I think that's your move.
Yeah. Some people said, you know, you need a cape and you need a cane.
Yeah. And Ben said feathers.
And that's funny.
Lean into the age. And just be a guy that's played with everybody that you haven't heard of yet.
Yeah.
Because you're in a really odd spot in your life right now.
Yeah. It is interesting. My plan was, again, you can plan, but you can't predict the weather, right?
Yeah.
I figured, put the music out, let the people decide. But I've also had a lot of help, you know, for this record. And again, like we're talking about how the community rallies, yeah, around the musician.
Yeah.
The music community knows when something is worthy.
Yeah.
And they're going to help you. And so there's a lot of people, all these people that came, and Ken Rich at the studio,
yeah,
and he spent from Grand so much Street, time, yeah, on
he
this.
He must have spent so much time
he
making this
spent
record.
So much time on it. And his family, yeah, had to listen to each mix.
Yeah.
And they tell me how, you know, he had to listen to this thing. So, you know, and we went to school together.
I didn't know that. Dixie, your wife told me that the other night.
We went to school in Madison.
What's her name?
Phoebe. Phoebe Flynn Rich.
So, and just coincidentally that happened?
Coincidentally that happened. So she's had to listen to all these mixes. And like the amount of you know, just people giving because they want to see this thing happen.
Yeah.
You know, that's a beautiful thing. That's love, man. And
yeah,
I don't shy away from it, because when people are willing to put something like that before themselves,
yeah,
that's so hard for people to do and say, well, I'm not going to hoard this
opportunity
from you.
Yes.
I'm not going to keep this from you,
yes,
because of
my own desire.
Yeah, to, you know what I mean?
Be successful.
We're just going to push this and because your success is my success.
Yes.
And people they'll flat out say that to,
yeah,
me. That to me has been the most touching part of this thing.
Yeah.
Because that didn't always happen.
Yes. Well, man, that's what I'm saying. Like, I just see the trajectory as really astonishing. Look, I guess if you live long enough, we're all going to be transformed if you keep working.
Well, that's what the Rolling Stone says. You just got to keep doing it.
Yeah.
If you really, you know, the thing with music is you just keep doing it because eventually something's going to, it's got to happen.
It's not going to happen where you think it will necessarily.
No.
But I mean, so you, all you can just do is be true to yourself and keep doing it. And, you know, and I really do feel that you probably are teetering on the edge of something. But on the other hand, whatever happens, you're going to have to wake up and write another song.
Right.
And play another gig.
Right.
There are people who work and work and climb a ladder so that they can, ultimately, they don't have to work anymore.
Yeah, so they can sit in front of the barbecue grill or the TV or whatever. You know,
which are both two great places to sit in front of. But I'm reminded of what John Ellis said to me a while ago, which was, the best case scenario from playing a gig is that it leads to another gig.
Sure.
And if you think about your whole life like that, like even if you are teetering on the precipice of some greatness, it's just going to be
another gig. You know, when I learned that is when we did that, when I got that Coca-Cola gig from you and I, we did the thing and they called me.
Were you sang on a Coca-Cola commercial that I hooked you up with?
Right.
Yeah.
And I, at that point I was like, okay, I've made it.
Yeah.
This is it. You know, I made some money and I was, you know, and I went to the movie theater and my name was Give a Little Love and It All Comes Back to You. Whatever.
Give a little love and it all comes back to you. You're gonna be remembered for the things that you say and do.
Saw it and I thought, okay, made it. But I was still just gigging. And then that gig passed. And
it was over.
And it was over. What I'm hoping for this situation is that the caliber of gig goes from, you know, and there's nothing wrong with playing any kind of, you know, local gigs, restaurant gig, whatever. You know, I like where I don't have to like perform, quote unquote. You know, I could just sit in the corner and swing and play some blues and maybe you clap, maybe you don't. I don't care. Like, I'm not doing it for people sometimes. I'm just doing it because this is how I live. This is how I feel good. This is my medium. I don't do drugs. This is just a thing. But that said, when I do perform, I would like to reach a different place.
Sure.
You know, we all want to be successful.
Yeah. I always say that too. Like, I don't want anything different. I just want more of it.
It also comes, there's a balance. You always have to keep a balance because you might want more, but sometimes you don't want all of that.
Yeah.
It's like I played last night. I played at the Bitter End.
Yeah.
It was a great show.
Yeah.
But the anxiety of doing a show like that, preparing for a show like that mentally, is different than just going playing some organ in the corner of a club.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a difference.
But that's something you need to search yourself about, really. Because I think, like, on the one hand, you have all the musicians in your corner because you write such honest tunes and you're so soulful and you're so fun to play with. You make it feel good. I mean, we know all the reasons why the musicians were. I could enumerate all the reasons.
Yeah.
But if there's ever a question about why you're not better known, you know, some people are just in it for themselves, and we're all up against those people.
Well, it's sales versus, I mean, there's music and there's the
sales
business.
Versus soul.
Oh, it's just music and the business of music.
Yeah.
It's two different things.
Yeah.
And so I'm learning how to do the business, or I'm hiring the people to help me do the business because I've realized now that in order for me to generate the type of, you know, it wasn't free for me to have, you have to give something up to generate the interest, to generate the place. So I've realized that I have to save my money and I have to pay my money in order to play this game. And that's the business aspect of the thing. And some people are ready to go with the money. They got the money.
Yeah.
They have the connections.
Yeah.
You know, and I came to that part late. You know, I didn't have the money.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily, I knew all the musicians, but all of them are, you can't just go to somebody and be like, yo, I need this hooked up and I need this and I need, they're like, yeah, whatever. We all do.
We all do.
We're all, you know, it's like crabs in a barrel.
Yeah.
You know? But once you have the money and you're going to meet the people, it's like my first, that middle record that I did.
Yeah.
I paid a woman $11,000 and she stole that money.
Hold on a second. No, just say that exact same thing you just said.
$11,000. That's a lot of bread. It's a lot of bread. Yeah, man. That's the blues. If that don't make you cry, I don't know what will. That's the blues.
Moses Petru, I am so happy to be your friend and be part of little part of your journey. I'm so excited for you. Thank you for confessing a little of your foolishness with me today, man.
Thank you, sir.
There he was, my friend Moses Petru. As sometimes happens in these conversations, I was inspired to write a song based on something he said. As a matter of fact, something he just said at the very end of our conversation. If that don't make you cry, I don't know what will. Here's my tribute to Moses and this wonderful conversation. If that don't make you cry, I don't know what will.
Spent all my money on a shot at fame. Might not be funny, but I do it again. 'Cause I'm tired of standing at the foot of this hill. If that don't make you cry, I don't know what will. I got lucky one or two times before. Just enough to keep me coming for more. Still trying to get another taste of the thrill. If that don't make you cry, I don't know what will. It's much too late for me to find another way to spend my time, or change the kinds of things I have on my mind. I might be tired, but I'm sure not resigned, 'cause I love the music and I love all my friends. All the abuse is just a means to an end. But sometimes I feel like I'm just grist in the mill. If that don't make you cry, I don't know what will. If that don't make you cry, I don't know what will. If that don't make you cry, I don't know what will.
I'll be back again in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.